he agreed that he would write when he came, but he did not have the letter that he said he would bring, and he didn't. He refused to use the PA system because he said, "Well, quote, it's only asking for trouble." And the police were also there. They had parked their horse wagon on the opposite side of the park that we come on, and they were there like with their horses patrolling the park, waiting for us. Because we heard them talking about, because we passed out flyers.
This was Saturday around 1 or 2?
Yeah, around like 2. And so the police were on their equestrian units waiting for us, and they saw the amp, and they tried to, they told us to that we couldn't have it on, but, and they tried to, see, the food was running behind because we were frying these potatoes to make some scrumptious french fries. And so the food was running a little behind the rest of the group who showed up on time. And so, basically people started talking to the cops, and the cops, thinking that seeing no food or seeing no us not planning to do anything for that moment, I guess they figured that they had defused the situation because they were, like, stalling and talking to us for forever. And then, so eventually, everyone just left where the cops were. It just got down to one person kind of like distracting the cop and talking to him, and then while everyone just kind of moved the tables and just ignored the police.
And you fed people anyway, huh?
Yeah.
Well, the police must have known eventually you were feeding people, right?
The police must have known?
Yes.
By the time the food got there, the police had already, I guess, thought that nothing was going to happen and moved on.
So there was no further harassment yesterday, but you didn't get satisfaction from the fellow who said he was going to write a letter and respond to how he was misquoted or improperly quoted by the Mercury News. He didn't really keep his promise, huh?
No, he didn't. And then we did talk to him, and then people were, asking questions, but he seemed to more like bore everyone to death and really, like a lot of, at first, we got a lot of people to gather around. We told them, why he is here. And then so people got interested in that, but then, frankly, the guy, he's pretty boring. So,
Well, at least he showed his face, which is
more than public officials.
Yeah,
I have to admit, that shows a little courage there in, to face the homeless in the park that this guy probably...
So do you have any plans for the future on this?
What?
Do you have any future plans?
Well, we're gonna see if he can come down to the park next week, and, and bring his letter this time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in the Mercury News today, in fact, in the perspective section, if you want to check it out, the Mercury wrote a whole page on the park, where they talk about their opinion, and I haven't read that article yet, and I'm pretty sure it probably says the usual stuff, like how they want to yuppify the park and turn it into a yuppie paradise.
You know, we spoke to another one of your group, Lennox, a couple days ago, and we let him know that in Salinas, at mid-month, this new ask for a dime after dark, go to jail law, up to 6 months in jail, is going to go into effect in Salinas, and that there may be some folks down there who want to do some protests and demonstrations, and maybe San Jose Food Not Bombs would be interested in joining them.
Yeah, sure. Hey, does Lennox have a fax machine? Maybe if you could fax something to somebody in our area, we can make a copy and then give it out at the meeting and talk to other people we know.
Possibly so. And is there any... I guess if any of the folks are interested in getting in touch with San Jose Food Not Bombs, who can they call?
We have a voicemail, and the number for the voicemail is 732-3320, extension 3664.
One more time.
Alright, 732-3320, extension 3664.
And if you missed that, you can always give a call locally to 423-HUFF. 423-4833, and I'll give you that number. But of course, we have a local Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz, which feeds Wednesdays and Thursdays the town clock at 4 o'clock, and that is downtown. It also feeds on Saturdays and Sundays at 1 o'clock, so it'll be feeding in about an hour. You can come on down there to the town clock and chow down, and you can also give them a call at 425-3345. Look, thank you very much, Adam. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, also in that article that's appearing today is another letter written by an individual, and so we may try to, we may try to find more people who are involved in the article, or maybe this mayoral candidate who asked the Mercury News to put this article in, and maybe, like, at their speeches, confront them with what's happening in the park, and maybe confront this other person who wrote a letter who basically said the same thing the article did, that all the people in the park are, like, trash and deserve to be swept away.
Well, keep us advised, and I encourage you to remember the real focus should be on the police and on the merchant associations. And I encourage you to take the struggle to the downtown association, the Chamber of Commerce, the Tourist Bureau, and, you know, start feeding in front of their headquarters and having people picketing there. That's where I think you're going to have maximum impact on shoppers. Encourage shoppers to boycott the downtown until these human rights violations end.
Yeah, we're discussing that. Maybe we should consider an extra serving in front of, like, maybe find out where some of these meetings of these people, where they conspire, and then do a serving right in front of the meeting at the same time. And so
sounds good to me, Adam.
I'm going to run
on you because I'm running out of time, but I really appreciate your calling in.
Sure, well, I have to go to work in 5 minutes, so.
All right. Thank you.
All right, later, Robert.
All right, then.
Bye-bye.
And that was Adam Welsh of San Jose Food Not Bombs giving us the update on what's going on right over the hill in, of course, a much larger urban area than Santa Cruz, but one that faces similar problems in terms of the kind of bigotry that poor people face, the kinds of scare stories and not-of-my-back neighborhood policies, and then, frankly, the kind of cynical political capital that is made off this whole problem by politicians who are running for office. I really haven't accused people like Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin of making political capital off of this, though perhaps I should here in Santa Cruz, because my general impression has been is they're just intimidated by what they consider to be certain sectors of public opinion from the merchants and from certain upper-class sectors, and perhaps sort of also entrenched in their own bad records on these issues and unwilling to change their minds or admit they might be in error. But it may also be a matter of making political capital, kind of trumping up a little hysteria around election time. Although with Scan on their team and, you know, kind of okaying whatever they do without any kind of real accountability, you know, they're going to get reelected anyway. So why should they worry? Actually, Rotkin and Kennedy can't be reelected at this point because they're in the middle of the end of, or in the midst of their terms. They can only have, I guess, two consecutive terms. But hey, we've got Matthews and Hernandez, and Rotkin still has 2 years to go on his term. So any of you folks who want to send a message to City Hall that maybe it's time to start paying attention to what Mayor Celia Scott and Catherine Byers are saying, and what the SCAN organization that elected them and those concerned with the rights of poor and homeless people are saying, and that what tenants are saying downtown, all these groups that don't get too much attention from our current city council. Recall might not be a bad idea, or something, some kind of significant, high-profile, persistent protest that holds these individuals elected with SCAN and student votes accountable. We'll see if that can happen. Let's take a break now, catch a little musical interlude before we return with 96.3 Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. And calling in, by the way, in case you're interested, can be easily done. Just give a call to 423-5361 if you have any thoughts on San Jose, if you have any thoughts on kind of bus going on downtown in downtown Santa Cruz for petty offenses. Let's hear from you. 423-5361. The lines are open.
Get up, stand up,
And we're back at Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we have a caller. Hi, caller.
Well, Mr. Norris, how are you doing this very nice Sunday morning or afternoon?
I'm okay. I'm indoors sipping coffee and managing the control panels here. How are you doing? This sounds like Bob LaMonica to me.
It certainly is. Yeah, hi.
Bob, you just got finished with a very successful work on a hemp festival that cleared how many thousands of bucks and had how many thousands of people? It was amazing.
Well, in terms of what it clears, you know, there's a settlement coming from the Civic eventually, and we're likely to come hopefully close to breaking even on the deal, and it would have never happened had it not been extended financially by some of the key players involved. That's number one that floated this thing. So if we end up close to breaking even, I think that would be very, very nice. There will be a Santa Cruz Industrial Hemp Expo in 1999, somewhere around a similar weekend. I don't think it can be considered other than a success. We drew between 5,000 and 6,000 people over 2 days, and definitely we set a standard for hemp expos in America. We drew people from all over the country here. It was very special, and the city of Santa Cruz was very special in this. The Civic was very special. It was a major collaborative effort on the part of a lot of people, and for me, I'm very proud to have been a part of it, and there is life after the Hemp Expo, and the dust will eventually settle on it all, and I think we, all of us who were involved on it, with it, deserve a good round of accolades. We were capable of bringing in a lot of talent to make the show very professional and to give it a good look. We drew a lot of mainstream people into the event, which is unusual for the hemp industry. And I just think it's a good thing all the way around. Good politics. It was good for the community, good for the cause.
Well, you know, you've also been instrumental in other public affairs kinds of pushes. For example, I know that you've frequently been trying to call D.A.R. Danner to task for crimes and misdemeanors, to no avail so far, but yet you've done a lot of educational work in the county, and I guess you're beginning your sixth or your seventh recall petition? What's the story?
Well, I'll leave Mr. Danner for that count. Mr. Danner wants to call it the seventh, and by the numbers, he's correct. There was the second attempt to recall Mr. Danner. Basically, Mr. Danner will be under perpetual recall as long as he holds public office. That's the bottom line. But the second time around, which was in the early part of 1996, the notice of intention was filed prior to qualifying it takes 20 signatures to launch a recall on a countywide basis. The notice of intention was not successfully qualified, so we had to refile. So there have been, this will be the seventh filing of a notice of intention. It'll come up sometime in April. The current recall ends on paper April 16th, and another one will be filed shortly thereafter.
Now, if you were to give us three quick reasons why you feel our Danner should be recalled, how would you summarize them?
An immune, slandering coward.
Well, you can elaborate.
I can get into details, and I'll give one detail. You know, there are details after details after detail, and this is beyond reasonable doubt, and that the community will eventually rise to the occasion and deal with the reality that their district attorney is a longstanding abuser of power. I'll give one instance that should have brought Mr. Danner out of office over 10 years ago, and if anybody wants to be other than dishonest, I think they would have to agree. When the victim of the district attorney's bodily injury car wreck is blood tested and he is not, something's going on that is not above board.
Are you talking about the case of
Sandra Larson? This was June 9th, 1987. All right, Mr. Danner had been drinking prior to the wreck. Sandra Larson has 4 broken teeth, among other things. She is hit by Mr. Danner coming out of a meeting at the Holiday Inn with some representatives from Honeywell Corporation regarding a new computer system for the DA's office. He claims to have had a gin and tonic and part of a second. Fact of the matter is the DA had been drinking, was under the influence of alcohol. Who gets the blood test? It isn't both parties. We're talking about a bodily injury car wreck here. All right. So we're talking really, in strict legal terms, felony drunk driving. So who gets the blood test? It isn't the at-fault drinking driver. It's the victim with 4 broken teeth in the hospital. All right. So now if we want to let that slip by and call it water under the bridge and old news, what we're doing is we're showing ourselves that we're cowardly and that cowardice does not require a formal conspiracy to be effective. Fact of the matter is that abuse of power is one of the most, if not the most significant issue of our time. And Mr. Danner is indicative of that factor. I'll give one other example, which really provided the momentum for perpetual recall, and that was the Catherine Gardner affair. And most of us who are close to the Danner situation are familiar with that. You got a situation where overlapping the DA's run for a fifth term, an assistant district attorney is put on paid administrative leave. Her time cards are falsified as unavailable. She sits at home for 17 weeks, full pay, full benefits, and to ride out the election. And the reason why has to come up. Well, Catherine Gardner had admitted to snorting some kind of powder in the spring of 1994. Right, so rather than bring the issue above board and deal with it, the district attorney, and I think it's important that we talk about what this office is. This is the district attorney with the power to prosecute. The DA, all right, rather than deal with it above board, playing fair and dealing straight, hushes it up, puts it under the table, pays her off, and when it does surface, which is in July of 94, way after the election, right, it winds itself down by making it to the Board of Supervisors, who in December of 1994 table it, and if my memory is correct, on April 6, 1995, resolution number 11495 procedurally exonerates Mr. Danner for the action of falsifying time cards, overlapping his election. The vote goes down 4-1, with Marty Wormhout being the one vote against resolution 11495. Let's keep in mind here, a year later, the Board of Supervisors of Santa Cruz County procedurally exonerates the district attorney for an action that no public official should have gotten away with. So what are we going to do? Are we going to look the other way? Are we going to be afraid? Are we going to be insecure? Are we going to rise to the occasion and say this is intolerable and this must stop, this must be accounted for? Now, the fact that Mr. Danner had nobody running against him is significant. And I think some of the reasons why will come out about that over the ensuing months. But I can assure you, and it's not just me, but Mr. Danner can rest assured that as long as he holds public office, he will be under recall.
Well, thank you, Bob LaMonica. And finally, I understand that you have taken a particular interest in another initiative measure that is blocking the streets, frequently walking the streets at night because folks aren't allowed to sleep at night, the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban in the city. You've been interested in that one as well, haven't you?
Absolutely, and this is another case of good politics, really. And Santa Cruz is not taking the lead necessarily in this issue. It's my understanding, Robert, that Eugene has repealed a similar ordinance in the name of human rights.
That's accurate. The Eugene has made a limited exception to their sleeping ban in industrial areas, which makes it legal for people to sleep in their vehicles in those areas.
So I think it's a very good initiative. It's something that I think anyone who considers the rights of others would be interested in. I think that it's a good way to raise the issue to a higher level. I certainly will help to do what I can to see that it makes a good mark and hopefully makes it to ballot.
And actually, anyone out there listening can get involved in this issue. You can give a call to the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban. You can either call 429-5284 or you can call 429-8529. Again, 429-8529 or 429-5284. And thank you, Bob, for calling in and give us updates as they happen.
Absolutely, Robert. You take care.
Thank you
for letting me call in.
Sure.
All right. Bye now.
And that was Bob LaMonica, a politically active person, not afraid to take an unpopular stand, and not afraid to go toe-to-toe with the district attorney's office. Certainly not a popular man around Art Danner's office. There's no question about that. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM is what you're listening to. This is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. I'm Bathrobes Pier. Call myself that because although I'm not wearing one now, you can occasionally see me wrapped up in a bathrobe and it's getting more and more tattered. Send your donations, please. In sleeping ban and other demonstrations that dramatize the rights of poor people to be in public spaces, something which is becoming increasingly difficult for poor folks and maybe for all of us as the police state grows apace, and particularly, again, if you're homeless or poor. The show can be found on your 96.3 at your 96.3 spot on the dial every Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning. We go till 1:30, and Thursday at 6 o'clock in the evening, go till 8 in the evening. If you want to be on the show, you can be on the show right now. All you got to do is pick up your phone, give a call to 423-5361. In fact, we're still hoping to hear from some folks who are going to call in with updates on the Resource Center for Nonviolence's decision to work hand on baton with a local police department in setting up an informant network in the Beach Flats. We're hoping to hear from Richard Quigley and Jerry Henry, who have been fighting the good fight out at Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center to allow young people to be in those public spaces without harassment from the sheriff's department and the merchants. And we'd hope to hear from them, but for some reason we haven't. We're probably going to try to give them a call ourselves, see if we can get through here. That's the royal we, me and the crackly phone lines. A couple weeks ago, and you've heard some selections on this in the past, we interviewed, well, we didn't really interview him. Well, we did interview him, but most of this isn't an interview. It's a recording of John Crew, who's an American Civil Liberties Union staff member and an attorney up in San Francisco, who he's been concerned with civil liberties issues, civil rights issues for, long time. And he came down to Watsonville to talk to folks about the problems of stereotyping young people that police are using kind of in a system out of Los Angeles in using gang profiles. And he described it in some detail. We began to hear this tape, I think it was a week and a half ago. We're going to continue listening to it now, unless and until we get some good incoming calls. And that's an option you guys have out there, and you women. Give us a call at 423-5361 about anything and everything that we've been discussing and possibly some of the things we haven't. And we'll put you on the air to continue that conversation. But now let's turn to John Crew, speaking to a group of Watsonville young people who have been concerned about police harassment, particularly of Hispanic youth in Watsonville.
It's clear that virtually every law enforcement agency is keeping their own list of whether or not they're linked up. Let me quickly tell you where GREAT comes from. It is a computer database. It is a gang fighting strategy that was first developed in Los Angeles. Now, it is true that Los Angeles knows something about gang violence. They've had a real problem with it. But from my point of view, again from a common sense point of view, have the law enforcement agencies in Los Angeles been successful in fighting gang violence? Have the tactics they've used engendered confidence from the community in dealing with these problems? We would suggest that you don't imitate tactics that have been proven to be a failure. But unfortunately, the tactics that have been used in Los Angeles in particular have spread throughout the state, and we're seeing them now all over Northern California. Now, the question is still, we're still learning more about what happens to individuals because they're in this database, because they're on a gang list. And sometimes it's kind of hard to figure out, because it's not always clear, one, that you've been labeled. It's not always clear to show the consequence of the label. But a few examples, and the ACLU has been involved in litigation around this issue and lawsuits. We had some clients a few years ago who were trying to go into Great America Amusement Park up in Santa Clara. These individuals had actually not been put on the list before, but three or four young African-American men were wearing, actually, they said they were all going to dress alike, and they were wearing, turns out they were actually pajamas with brightly colored billiard balls on them. All right, they were pool balls. They thought it was a cute way to dress. I don't obviously know anything about fashion, but that was what they wanted to wear that night. And when they went to the gate of Great America, they were stopped by the security guards. And they were told, that's gang attire. It's their pajamas. No, that must be a gang insignia, because those aren't clothes that I would wear. And those young men were labeled gang members and kicked out of the park. And the ACLU filed a lawsuit on their behalf and were able to not only obtain some damages to compensate them for what happened to them, but also obtain the settlements so that Great America would stop doing that. Now, where did Great America learn this gang profile? Well, we found it in the litigation is the law enforcement agencies have been teaching them how to do it. And we see the same tactic being used, unfortunately, in shopping malls. We see problems with, now at this point, they are moving the technology to try to make this information accessible in the patrol car when they stop someone. I was on the radio with the person who's in charge of the Cal Gang system, and they first, the host actually first asked them, well, you know, that's exactly the purpose of this Cal Gang system. And the guy said, well, it's kind of like the list of registered sex offenders. You know, there's a list of registered sex offenders in the state. They keep track of these people. And to his credit, before I could jump all over it, the host said, wait a minute. Those people are convicted felons. And the people on the gang list haven't even been arrested for anything. And then he quickly changed gears and said, well, it's not really about crime, it's about gangs. Well, if it's not about crime, why are you collecting this information? But he went on to say that from his point of view, from law enforcement's point of view, it's an officer safety issue. They want every cop in the state to know every time they stop a car or a young person whether or not somebody has been labeled a gang member. Now again, you're being labeled a gang member without your knowledge and without any sort of meaningful criteria, without any sort of notice or due process or opportunity to challenge. And so what we find is, you know, a lot of different systems use different policies about what a gang member supposedly looks like, but it really boils down to the duck test. The duck test meaning if it looks like a duck, if it waddles like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. Well, that may make sense if you're duck hunting. It doesn't make sense if you're labeling somebody essentially as a criminal and putting them in a database to be shared statewide. We actually had a program in Northern California, ACLU, where we had a group of students that went out to research issues on juvenile justice issues, and this is one of the topics they were interested in. And they sat down with me, they were going to go meet with the head of the gang task force in San Francisco. They said, John, you know, what should we ask them? And I said, well, you know, ask them what policy they have, how they go about classifying people as gang members. And I jokingly said, you know, they'll probably tell you it's the duck test. An hour later, they went down and sat down with this guy, and they said, what criteria are you using? And he literally said, well, we use the duck test. If it quacks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck. Well, you know, it's a funny answer, but the consequences are very serious. We are now seeing a tactic where instead of waiting to arrest someone based on evidence of a crime, taking them through the process with the right of an attorney, where guilt has to be established before a jury who appears beyond a reasonable doubt, before they actually do something to you, sentence you, or punish you, They're doing an end run around the Constitution by seeking civil injunctions. What's a civil injunction? Well, it is not something where you're actually arrested for doing anything wrong, but because they think you might be involved in criminal activity, because they've got you on the gang list, and there very well may be a real problem with gang activity and gang crimes. But they are then going into court and getting a court order against you. You have no right to an attorney, no right to a trial, a jury of your peers, and really, there is no requirement that they prove you've done anything wrong, and people throughout the state are being ordered by courts to stay out of their own neighborhood. Literally, they're being banned from their own neighborhood, banned from talking to friends, banned from talking to family members because of this happening. So it's very dangerous and very serious, and it's spreading. Let me give you some numbers from it. While there are a variety of labels that are used and criteria for labeling gang members, almost without exception, the only people that are being labeled gang members in the state of California are people of color.
And you're listening to John Crew talking about the use of a gang member labeling system to remove the civil liberties of a large number of people. But let's turn now to a call we've been waiting for. We're going to go to our phone line and talk to two men who have been fighting for, well,